Thank you. Yes, I always feel when I come to the Tri-Societies meeting that there's a lot of talk about plants, and that's great because they're very important. But so just for something completely different, we're going to talk about animals and soils. So this is some of the work that my lab has been doing over the last few years, looking at animal vertebrate mortalities and decomposition and some of the influences that these decomposition hotspots have on soils in terms of biogeochemistry and soil microbial communities. So when we think about animals in the environment, we tend to think about their impacts when they're alive. We think about what they eat or who eats them, where they fit in the food web, their contributions to biodiversity, or maybe even how they're manipulating the environment around them, like this industrious beaver here. We don't think as much about what happens to them after they die, but of course they're still part of the ecosystem. An animal is basically a pocket of nutrients and moisture, and that all needs to get redistributed back into the ecosystem that it came from. And so this process occurs with a very diverse and interesting community of organisms. We have scavengers that will frequently come in to feed on a carcass. We have decomposers, the bacteria and fungi that move in to remineralize all of the tissues back to their constituents. There's a number of insects that take advantage of decomposing or decaying flesh, either to deposit their eggs or their larvae for development, or insects such as carrion beetles that feed on the tissue directly. And not only do we have these primary consumers of dead and decaying tissue, but then we have a whole suite of secondary organisms that move in as well. So, for example, the bloom of bacteria and fungi often attract other organisms such as slime molds and nematodes that come in to feed on all the blooming bacteria. And the maggots often attract secondary consumers such as predatory insects or birds that will move in to feed on this maggot mass. So this one organism, this one beaver in this case, is supporting this whole diverse mini pop-up ecosystem. But the thing about this fascinating ecosystem is that it's very ephemeral. It's here for a very short period of time, and then once all the tissues are gone, which generally happens quite rapidly, they all move on to the next thing. And the reason animals decompose so quickly, and the reason this is such an ephemeral event, is because of the nature of animal tissues. They are a high-quality resource, so they have narrow C-to-N ratio. They're high in nitrogen and high in moisture, and so they decompose very quickly if we compare it to, say, plant litter, which tends to decompose much more slowly and steadily over time. And so a very typical decay curve for an animal carcass is usually kind of sigmoidal in nature, and it starts with a kind of a lag time if we're looking at percent mass, and this is the time when the carcass is bloating. And what's going on is the animal's intestinal microflora will start to ferment and decompose the cellular products that are breaking down inside the animal. This will produce a lot of gases, and the carcass will bloat up. At some point, those gases and fluids have to find their way out, and so the carcass will start to lose integrity. Those fluids and gases will leak out. We get a period of rapid mass loss. And this is when we start to see the impacts on the ecosystem around it. So in this case, we start to see formation of this fertility island or this decomposition island where all these fluids are rushing into the soil. And once most of the soft tissue is gone, we enter a period that we call advanced decay. There are still some things left. We get the more recalcitrant compounds like bones and teeth and hair and that sort of thing, but decomposition has slowed way down and most of it is gone. And just to give you an idea of just how quickly this process happens, in East Tennessee, where we do our experiments, which experience hot, humid summers, in the summertime we can see an animal go from flesh and bones to just skeleton in about 2 to 3 weeks. So it happens very, very rapidly. And so what this gives us is a hot spot and a hot moment. So if we think of the biogeochemistry and the microbial ecology of this system, we get this localized pulse of nutrient-rich stuff seeping into the soil, so that's our local hot spot. And it's a hot moment because it's fairly transient. It's there for a short period of time, and then eventually things are mineralized and it goes away, if you will. So what my lab is working on is trying to better understand the response of soil microbial communities in these decomposition hotspots. Plant litter decomposition has been well studied, and it's an important area of study, but animal decomposition just doesn't have the same attention given to it, and we understand a lot less about the processes and the types of microbes that are involved in recycling these minerals. And so that's what we've been investigating, and our hypothesis here is that, not very surprisingly, things are going to change in these hot spots. So as decomposition is occurring and releasing metabolites and products into the soil, this is going to select and shift the soil microbial community, things that either can tolerate the changing conditions or take advantage of this newly available nutritious resource and start to bloom in that environment. And those microbes then in turn will assist with further decomposition, and so we kind of have this positive feedback cycle going on in these environments. So let's take a look at what actually happens in one of these decomposition hotspots. So these data just show soil temperatures during one of these decomposition events, and you can probably see this pretty pronounced, if I can get my cursor back, this fairly pronounced spike in soil temperatures, well above what the daily max is. So we're looking at temperatures north of 40 degrees Celsius in the soils, and this corresponds to that period of active decay. So when we first get that fluid flush into the soils, and microbial activity just starts ramping up, and so we see that in this elevated temperature. We also see evidence of this when we look at soil oxygen. So oxygen the soil goes from a fairly oxygenated state at the start, and that we see a rapid drawdown of oxygen in these soils. It goes anaerobic very, very quickly, and eventually will bounce back to that state. So we're seeing high temperatures, low oxygen, indicates a lot of microbial activity and consumption of that oxygen. We also see a number of other changes that are starting to give us hints about what's going on. We typically see elevated pH in all these graphs. We have the decomposition process from the initial soils through the skeletal stage. And in all of these graphs, the stars refer to our control soils, so you can see how much variability there is in the environment around. But we see elevated pH, and we see changes in conductivity in these soils, which is not surprising given the amount of stuff coming into it. We do see elevated carbon dioxide emissions, so we do see elevated respiration rates, which is, again, not surprising given the nutritious resources coming in that we're going to have enhanced microbial activity. Interestingly, we see a drop-off in bacterial production measured using the triated leucine uptake method. So we're seeing this shift towards a low microbial growth efficiency in these communities, and that suggests to us that they're moving from aerobic to anaerobic metabolisms primarily. So this actually fits with the soil oxygen profiles that we're measuring. Interestingly, we also see slightly elevated methane production from these soils, so we think that there is some methanogenesis or methane release processes going on. And then on the nitrogen side, we're starting to better understand where all the nitrogen that's in this carcass is ultimately going. When we look at soil protein, we do see a little bit of enrichment of protein, but it's not significantly different from our control soils, at least it wasn't in this experiment. So we think that the proteins that are in that decomposition fluid may be rapidly consumed by those organisms. And what would support that idea is that we see this big spike in ammonia, and this is a very characteristic of Graves soils or decomposition soils in general, is this big spike in ammonia to the point that it becomes toxic to some organisms. And you can even see that in the plant communities in these systems. We also see very late in decay an elevation of nitrous oxide production. And combining that with the oxygen profile suggests to us that denitrification is occurring. Interestingly, in all these systems, we measure very little nitrate. So we don't know if I would assume that the ammonia oxidizers are probably inhibited by the lack of oxygen, and any nitrate that is being produced may be rapidly consumed or denitrified in this condition. So it's starting to give us a picture of how things are cycling. So we also want to look at the types of microbes that are doing this and see if we can learn more about who's doing this cycling. And so going into this, we had a hypothesis that three microbial populations or groups would be involved in this system. So the first one, and maybe the most obvious, is the soil microbes, okay? So they're receiving this this pulse of nutrient-rich stuff, and so we would see a bloom of soil microbial communities that can either tolerate or take advantage of this new system. The other communities we wanted to consider were communities that were present in the host, either in the carcass or cadaver that we were working with. So I mentioned at the beginning that early on in decay, your intestinal microbes become very active in fermenting cellular breakdown products. And so these microbes should be very active early on, and at some point they're going to get flushed into the soil. So we wanted to kind of see if they were playing a role in decomposition. And then the third group to consider, I mentioned all the insects and scavengers and other things that come visit a decaying corpse, and if they are contributing any microbes to the system. And so using targeted metagenomic sequencing, we've looked at communities in some of these grave soils. In this case, this is a study using human cadavers and the microbial communities below, and we do see a big shift. So our starting soils look a lot like other soil communities, and we see this big swing as decay progresses. The biggest changes we see are in Firmicutes, which go from a few percent of the community to over 50% of the community in early advanced decay. And then we see disappearance of other phyla, such as the Verruca microbia and the Acidobacteria, suggesting that they're probably sensitive or less competitive in this environment. Given our big increase in pH, that explains the Acidobacteria going away at least. So we do see some massive changes in this community. Unfortunately, we didn't run this experiment. We thought we had run it a while, and it looks like this community may be going back to its original state, but we didn't run long enough to see if it would ultimately rebound. If we drill down and look at the genera and the taxa that are significantly changing decomposition, we noticed a few interesting things. So the taxa that are coming up midway through decay, so these would be the things that are blooming in the soil, all tended to be facultative anaerobes. Again, this fits the reduction in microbial growth efficiency and the drawdown of oxygen, and so we are seeing the shift towards anaerobic taxa as well. We additionally were able to identify several insect-associated taxa, so these are taxa that have been isolated from either larvae or flies, and aren't typically found in soils in high abundances. And we are able to identify host-associated taxa. So in this case, these are taxa that are commonly found in human guts, but are not typically found in soils, at least not in very high abundances, and they were all blooming in the system. So we are seeing evidence that all three of these groups are playing, or we don't know that they're playing a role, but all three of these groups are at least present in these grave soils. And so what we're investigating next in my group is how these groups either participate in decomposition, compete, collaborate. We're not really sure what the ecology of these three populations in this sort of weird invasion scenario is, and what that ultimately means for decomposition. But we are starting to get a little bit of a picture of what goes on, looking at the biogeochemistry and some of the changes along with the microbial populations. We're kind of excited to follow up on some of these questions about how these populations affect the chemistry. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge the lab members that have all helped on this project, collaborators at both UT and ARS, and the human cadaver work is all done at the Forensic Anthropology Center at the University of Tennessee, so thanks to the faculty and staff that collaborate with me on that. Of course, thank you to the donors of families that donated these cadavers as well. This work is funded by NSF. We had a small equipment grant from Decagon Devices to do some of this work as well, and funds from my home institution. So thank you. I'm Canadian. This was very conflicting for me. Yes, there you go. There we go. They were already dead when I got them. I wasn't involved in the euthanization.
So what proportion of the soil community responds to the release of taxa from the gut, for example, once incorporated, versus what's there in the
Right, so that's a great question. So we know that our guts are dominated by Firmicutes. That's a major portion of it, and we see this big increase in the soils. And that was one of the first questions we had, is this just gut bacteria that we're picking up? And it's yes and no. We do pick up the gut bacteria, but when we drill down at the taxa level, the Firmicutes that are blooming, that are changing significantly, are not ones that would normally be in the gut. So they are soil Firmicutes that are just doing really, really well in this environment. So it's a combination of both. We don't have numbers on what the relative proportion is, and that's something that we'd like to tease apart. Good question. Yes, and it also brings up public health implications as well. So if you think about persistence of pathogens in the environment, one of the things we looked at with this study, when we saw that there were human gut bacteria in the soil, we actually went in with a targeted qPCR assay looking at human-associated bacterioides specifically, and found that they persisted in these soils essentially as long as that anaerobic condition was maintained. So up to a year later, we were still detecting human bacteroides in these soils. And then once we kind of aerated the system, they went away. So it tells us that in a pathogen scenario, they may actually persist in these decomposition environments for quite long periods of time as long as that anaerobic condition stays in place. That's a good point. I would love to, because we've only done the bacteria so far. Fungi are a big part of it. They've long been documented. If you go back through the forensic literature that's looked at decomposition, they've documented fungal growth, but there's only been a few groups that are starting to use molecular tools to characterize them. So we'd like to look at those next. Yeah, so if you have a large scavenging event, then there's not much to decompose. What we get at, so we caged the beavers, so we wouldn't have scavenging. When we work at the Forensic Anthropology Center, we don't cage or exclude scavengers, and the largest thing we get is raccoons. So we get a lot of rodents and raccoons, but no large scavengers there. And they will typically feed on the extremities. They go for the arms and the legs and the feet, more so than the torso. So I think minor scavenging like that is not actually going to have a big impact on these dynamics, because we still have the gut microbes and the main torso intact. We've not done that. I think it's an interesting question. I don't know how related this is, but there was a really interesting study that looked at microbial communities associated with bones of human skeletons after decomposition, and they noted that the bones closer to the torso, to the gut, had a community that looked more like the gut, and whereas the extremities had communities that look more like soil communities. So that suggests that location does matter, actually, in terms of pressure. And it makes a difference if you want to think about what a mouse would do versus an elephant. So that's a good question.
Could you speculate on how this bacteria
Yeah, so we've done one comparison study so far. I will get to your question. We've done one comparison study so far between humans and pigs. Pigs are often used in forensic decomposition studies because they're considered a human analog. We have similar diets and digestive system, and we have hair, not fur, and all that. And we saw differences between humans and pigs. We saw differences in pH of the grave soils, and we saw differences in protease activity between the two. So that suggests to us that even something as similar as humans and pigs may be decomposing differently. We've done some composting experiments with ruminants, with cows, and from a managed decomposition perspective, they decompose fairly similar to say, a pig. But I haven't done it in the soil sense. I don't know. It's a great question, though.